content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the August 8, 2014 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Israel intensifies its Gaza campaign. What happened? Israel stepped up its devastating air and ground offensive against Gaza this week, warning that it would require a long campaign to destroy Hamas's stockpile of thousands of rockets and networks of tunnels. Israel pounded targets that included houses, mosques, and schools, which it said were being used by Hamas to house weapons and tunnel entrances. Several United Nations facilities were hit, along with Gaza's only power plant. The mounting civilian death toll from these strikes prompted strong international condemnation. By Wednesday, 3 weeks after the conflict began, more than 1,250 civilians had been killed in Gaza, including at least 200 children. On the Israeli side, 53 soldiers and 3 civilians had been killed. "In the name of humanity, the violence must stop," said UN Secretary Ban Ki-moon. "It is unjustifiable." Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu insisted his country had to defend itself from Hamas's continued rocket attacks and to destroy the tunnels used to hide weapons and enable Hamas militants to sneak into Israel for attacks. The IDF has so far found at least 31 tunnels, some of them stocked with tranquilizers, handcuffs, and other hostage-taking equipment. In Washington, the White House defended Secretary of State John Kerry, whose proposed truce agreement was unanimously rejected by the Israeli cabinet. "Israel has no better friend, no stronger defender," said Deputy National Security Advisor Tony Blinken. "He has been tireless in his efforts." What the editorial said: "For all the horror of this incursion, Israel has a legitimate mission to protect its citizens," said the Chicago Tribune. "In 7 years of rule over Gaza, Hamas did nothing to alleviate the misery of the populace. It had but one item on its agenda: destroy Israel." Even before the current fighting started, a poll found that 9 out of 10 Gazans wanted the Palestinian Authority to take control. Their disenchantment provides the seeds of a real peace deal, one in which Gaza is demilitarized and leadership shifts to Palestinians bent on helping Gazans thrive, not on destroying Israel. "But Israel will also have to make genuine concessions," said The Economist. "This conflict ultimately stems from the Jewish state's refusal to negotiate in good faith over a potential Palestinian state encompassing both Gaza and the West Bank. To make amends, Netanyahu has to stop authorizing the building of settlements on occupied territory, and he must also lift the blockade and restrictions that have turned Gaza into the world's biggest open-air prison." What the columnist said: "I'm a lifelong supporter of Israel," said Ezra Klein in Vox.com, "but its actions are becoming increasingly hard to defend. Yes, Hamas is culpable for using civilians as human shields, but the brutality of Hamas's tactics doesn't justify the brutality of Israel's response. Netanyahu's heavy-handed approach isn't just unethical. It will also leave Israel isolated and surrounded by increasingly radicalized enemies. No Palestinian man who watched his daughter die in an Israeli airstrike would moderate his politics." "Blaming Israel for the civilian casualties is moral idiocy," said Brett Stevens in the Wall Street Journal. "Hamas's barbarian embedded rocket launchers and tunnels among homes and schools and in urban warfare, civilian deaths are inevitable. When U.S. forces took Fallujah from Iraqi militants in 2004, 800 civilians were killed and 9,000 homes were destroyed. By the way, American towns and cities were not being rocketed from above and tunneled from below as the Fallujah campaign was underway. Coming weeks may bring the best opportunity to oust Hamas, said Amos Yadlin in NYTimes.com. The group is reeling under Israel's offensive, and it has lost the political support of the crushed Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, many Palestinians, and the larger Islamic world. To capitalize, Israel should insist that any ceasefire is conditional on Hamas's completely disarming and on the Palestinian authorities returning to Gaza in some governing capacity. It's a long shot, but these conditions would finally clear the way for Gaza's reopening to the world so that its people could at last prosper in peace. Well, it wasn't all bad. 6-year-old Alex Pring was born without a right arm, and because of his age, he doesn't have insurance for prosthetics. But this week, engineering students at the University of Central Florida fitted him with an electronic arm made using a 3D printer. The high-tech plastic limb, which responds to the muscles in Alex's bicep, cost his family $350. Standard prosthetics go for up to $40,000. Once fitted, Alex immediately gave his mom, Allison, what he called his first real hug. "When he hugged me with two hands, he just didn't let go," she said. And Charlie Tillotson had always cherished her long blonde hair and wanted to grow it like Rapunzel. But after the British 6-year-old watched a documentary about children with cancer, she promptly changed her mind. She came up to me and said, "Daddy, would you mind if I had all my hair cut off for children with cancer?" said her father, Steve. I welled up. 2 feet of her hair were cut off and sent to the Little Princess Trust to be made into a wig that might otherwise have cost as much as $8,000. When her locks grow back, Charlie plans to donate again. Our controversy of the week: Obamacare. Will a drafting error lead to its collapse? Make no mistake, it's a ruling that could endanger or even destroy Obamacare, said Megan McArdle in BloombergView.com. A federal appeals court last week ruled that under the wording of the Affordable Care Act, the federal government cannot provide subsidies to 4.7 million Americans who've bought insurance through federal exchanges. The ACA, of course, was designed to make insurance available to people who are not covered by employers. To make that easier, the government set up exchanges of private insurers where people could shop for policies, with the federal government providing subsidies to most lower and middle income enrollees. But when the House and Senate versions of the ACA were hurriedly combined, the law came to say that subsidies would be provided through an exchange established by the state. No mention was made of the federal exchanges providing subsidies, a major problem, given that 36 states later refused to set up exchanges, forcing the feds to do it. In a 2-to-1 ruling along ideological lines, a panel of a U.S. appeals court in Washington, D.C., ruled in the case of Halbig versus Burwell that the law must be enforced as written. Poof! There goes the health law in most of the country, said E.J. Dion in the Washington Post. This bit of judicial sophistry will not withstand appeal. But in case it wasn't already obvious, the right is now nakedly relying on judicial activism to overturn laws and precedents. Law is nothing if not language, said Kevin Williamson in NationalReview.com. The two judges now being smeared as conservative hacks merely upheld the vital principle that the law says what the law says. Now, it may well be the ACA, as written, doesn't work the way the Obama administration hoped it would. But that's a problem for Congress to fix, not the courts. This was no mere drafting error, as liberals contend, said Sean Davis in TheFederalist.com. The law was written to give states an incentive to set up their own exchanges. Only after most states declined to set up an exchange did the government decide to hand out subsidies to everyone. That version of events is fundamentally dishonest, said Brian Beutler in NewRepublic.com. If it were Congress's intention to deny subsidies to people who enrolled in federal exchanges, why was that issue not debated or even mentioned during the three brutal years it took to craft the law? The issue is probably moot, said Ezra Klein in Vox.com. For how big to matter, the U.S. Supreme Court would have to uphold it on appeal, and that's not going to happen. The court simply isn't going to rip insurance from tens of millions of people due to an uncharitable interpretation of congressional grammar. Don't be so sure, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. Chief Justice John Roberts may have broken ranks with his conservative colleagues to rule the ACA constitutional in 2012, but he's shown in other rulings he moves incrementally to advance the conservative cause. The language flaw in the ACA may give him cover to sabotage the program. Judges are supposed to be above politics, but they're human, said Matthew Iglesias in Vox.com. Roberts' conservative friends and allies have never forgiven him for his act of ideological apostasy on Obamacare. Liberals are making a mistake to simply assume he'll betray his side again. Well, it was a good week for acts of God after a Tennessee man was charged with burglary when a tornado ripped open his home and scattered a host of items he'd allegedly stolen from neighbors, including an air hose, a weed trimmer, and a ratchet for everyone to see. It was a good week for more acts of God after Florida police said a drunk driver jumped out of his truck to berate a woman motorist he'd rear-ended, only to be run over when he left his vehicle in gear. Joseph Call, 48, fractured his hand and foot and was charged with DUI. It was a good week for getting motivated after a Boston-based inventor developed a bracelet that gives wearers a painful electric shock if they fail to meet daily fitness targets. Sometimes crazy works, said creator Manish Sethi. It was a bad week for the Colorado Rockies, who handed out 15,000 jerseys honoring all-star shortstop Troy Tulowitzki, but misspelled his name Tulowizki instead of Tzki on the shirts. Is there something wrong with it? One fan asked. I didn't notice with the name being so long. It was a bad week for texts from hell after a Polish priest claimed his cell phone was being inundated with hateful text messages from a demon that he'd tried to exorcise. The owners of mobile phones are not even aware that they are being used like this, said the priest. And it was a bad week for childhood heroes after New York City cracked down on costumed characters who aggressively hassled tourists for tips in Times Square, arresting Captain America, Jessie the Cowgirl from Toy Story, and at least two Spider-Men. On the briefing page, the troubled F-35. The Pentagon's expensive new fighter jet has been plagued by problems. Will it ever get off the ground? What is the F-35? It's a state-of-the-art fighter jet that's supposed to seal Americans' dominance over the world's skies. Conceived in 1996, the Lockheed Martin F-35 Lightning II was to be put into operation starting in 2010 to gradually replace the Pentagon's aging fleet of fighters, such as the F-16 and the FA-18, many of which were built in the 1970s and 80s. But in the 18 years since its conception, the F-35 has proven to be so technologically ambitious that Lockheed can't get it finished. There have been endless delays, budget overruns, and technical failures. The plane was recently grounded again because of an engine fire, the 13th grounding since 2007. Since the F-35 has been repeatedly redesigned, the cost of developing the plane has doubled to a record-breaking $400 billion, the most expensive weapons system ever. A single plane will cost $185 million to produce. The F-35's deployment has been pushed back to 2015 at the earliest, with the Pentagon calling its performance immature and unacceptable, and many military experts question whether it will ever operate as intended. Can't turn, can't climb, can't run, concluded one scathing RAND Corporation study. How advanced is the F-35? In theory, it will be the most lethal fighter ever made. The do-it-all fighter can both bomb land targets and engage in air-to-air combat, covering the diverse needs of the Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps. Its radar-absorbing coating, coupled with its supersonic speed, allow the stealth fighter to swoop into combat zones before the enemy can detect it coming. The single-engine, single-seat plane carries groundbreaking software technology that's used to control a futuristic video screen inside the pilot's helmet. Information from several cameras mounted around the plane is fed back into that helmet, giving the pilot a 360-degree view during dogfights and bombing runs. This aircraft reinforces the way Americans go to war, said Air Force Lieutenant General Frank Gorenk. We don't want to win 51-49. We want to win 99-0. Does the technology work? It often does not. The helmet's video resolution, for example, is far worse than that of the naked eye, so pilots struggle to pick out the tiny dots in the distance that could represent an enemy threat. Many other malfunctions have been ironed out in the last decade or so of development. This is an incredibly complex aircraft, said Air Force Colonel Rod Krieger. Getting it right isn't easy. Keeping it right won't be easy either. The F-35 will cost up to 40% more to maintain than previous fighter jets have, and a Pentagon study estimated the lifetime maintenance cost of all the jets at $1 trillion. And even when it works properly, the F-35 is handicapped by one fatal design flaw. What's that? It's vertical takeoff equipment. The Marine Corps insisted the plane have jump jet capability so that fighters could take off from the short landing decks of the Corps' amphibious assault ships. But vertically lifting a plane that weighs up to 35 tons requires about 40,000 pounds of thrust, so Lockheed added a powerful lift fan. The bulky fan assembly has increased the drag of the plane, making its acceleration, fuel efficiency, and flying range inferior to even older Chinese jets. To rub salt in the wound, China is now developing its own ripoff of the F-35 based on Pentagon blueprints stolen by Chinese hackers. The J-31 comes without the F-35's compromising jump jet lift fan. As a result, it's faster and more maneuverable. What are the alternatives? The Pentagon could restart production on the F-22 line, though that system has been dogged by its own problems, including its pilots regularly experiencing oxygen deprivation and blackouts while flying. Or military officials could skip the so-called fifth generation of fighters like the F-35 and move straight to the sixth, which will apparently focus on giving jets laser weaponry. Other military experts argue that the Pentagon should drop its World War II-era dependence on piloted combat altogether, given that it's barely used in military conflicts around the world today, and instead focus on unmanned drone and robotic warfare. But both the Pentagon and Congress now seem irrevocably locked into the F-35 project. Why is that? Perverse as it sounds, the program has become too expensive to quit. Congressional lawmakers are also keenly aware that the project supports 133,000 jobs, a number that will grow to 260,000 when full-scale production begins in 45 states, and are reluctant to sacrifice so many American jobs. Many of America's allies have also made commitments to buying the F-35, and it would damage U.S. prestige to cancel those sales. So the Pentagon is committed to producing 2,400 fighter jets that analysts say could actually weaken America's aviation advantage. My prediction is the F-35 will be such an embarrassment, says aircraft engineer and defense analyst Pierre Spray, that it will be canceled before 500 are built. Turn now to take a look at our columns, best columns, starting with the U.S. This one comes from Mark Adamanis from the Washington Post. Russia's reality problem. Russia is not living in the reality-based community, said Mark Adamanis. Since Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 went down, the country's media has been awash with conspiracy theories. Was the plane shot down by NATO to spark a conflict with Russia? Was it stuffed with week-old corpses, not innocent victims? All totally ridiculous, of course, but many Russians at all levels of society buy into theories usually found among people wearing tinfoil hats. Russia's media has convinced much of the country that the Donetsk People's Republic is now an independent nation of ethnic Russians under attack from Ukrainian neo-Nazis. Shockingly large numbers of Russians do not believe 9/11 was caused by an Al-Qaeda attack. Even a meteor strike in Siberia was blamed on the test of a new American superweapon. Such gullibility stems in part from Russia's long history as a rural peasant society in which fables and superstitions abound. Decades of Soviet propaganda have also created a deeply ingrained conviction that nothing is as it seems. As Russia once again retreats into paranoid isolation, its population is living in an alternate reality. And a couple of international columns. The first, How They See Us. A hapless mediator in Gaza. Is U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry an alien who just disembarked his spaceship in the Middle East? Asked Barak Ravid in Haaretz. His attempt at mediating a ceasefire in Gaza raises serious doubts over his judgment. Israel has already endorsed an Egyptian ceasefire proposal. So when Kerry arrived in the Middle East last week, his task was to persuade Hamas to sign on as well. Instead, he tore it up and presented a new draft to the Israeli cabinet that contained the entire Hamas wish list: an unconditional Israeli ceasefire, the lifting of the blockade, no more targeting Hamas tunnels leading into Israel, and no disarming of Hamas. Such a plan would reward the Islamist group for launching thousands of rockets at Israel and trash the credibility of Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, who has pursued a peaceful solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. This was nothing less than a betrayal of Israel, said David Horovitz in the Times of Israel. The entire Israeli cabinet, right-wing and left-wing members alike, reacted with horrified rejection and leaked their impressions of Kerry to the Israeli press, calling him amateurish, incompetent, incapable of understanding the material he is dealing with. In short, a blithering fool. After that debacle, Kerry snubbed Israel, Egyptian and Palestinian Authority input, and jetted off to a meeting with Hamas's friends, Turkey and Qatar. Jerusalem now regards him as duplicitous and dangerous. The Palestinian Authority doesn't trust Kerry either, said Adli Sadiq in Al-Hayat Al-Jadidah. The failed and hated mediator came to negotiate a ceasefire only after it was reported that an Israeli soldier had been captured. The deaths of hundreds of Palestinian civilians, including scores of children, apparently failed to move him. When he did arrive, he talked to Hamas allies instead of Abbas's Fatah movement and the elected Palestinian leadership. From now on, Palestinians just might refuse to listen to the Secretary of State. Don't blame Kerry, said Samir Atala in Ashark al-Awsat. He's just the foreign policy face of a weak U.S. administration. Barack Obama is a president who never stops going back on his words. His position on Gaza has changed multiple times, demonstrating America's confused vision and weak foreign policy. No wonder nobody respects U.S. diplomats anymore, said Muhammad al-Mamid in Akbar al-Khalij. Last week, Egyptian authorities, in a brave precedent, subjected Kerry and his aides to a security screening before allowing them to meet with Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. With that, Kerry has become a laughingstock, and so has the U.S. And this from West Africa. West Africa, the twin contagions of Ebola and panic. Ebola has West Africa in its bloody grip, said Sola Ogundipe in Vanguard from Nigeria. Over the past 6 months, the worst outbreak in history of the deadly hemorrhagic disease has killed nearly 700 people across Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, including some of the region's top doctors. It has racked up an alarming series of firsts. The first Ebola outbreak that is urban rather than rural, the first to hit capital cities, and the first to cross borders of more than three countries. The disease has even struck Lagos, Nigeria, Africa's most populous city, where a Liberian civil servant collapsed upon arrival at the airport last week and died in a hospital a few days later. Nigeria acted swiftly and quarantined the hospital, and hopefully the disease can be contained here. But it is still spreading in West Africa, not least because fear of Ebola has sparked crazy rumors that are making the problem more difficult to contend with. Locals are attacking healthcare workers, fearing they are lying about the disease or are carriers themselves, and quarantine patients are breaking out of hospitals. Ignorance is rife, said the Inquirer from Liberia in an editorial. Out in the villages, unscrupulous individuals prey on the desperate, peddling fake vaccines and herbal cures. We urge all citizens to listen to the health ministry. There is no vaccine or cure for Ebola, and the death rate is 90%. It starts with a fever, proceeds to vomiting and bleeding, and spreads through bodily fluids. Those infected are more likely to survive if they are promptly hospitalized. The trouble is, nobody trusts our government, said Alaskai Moore Johnson, the Daily Observer. Last week, a man set fire to the health ministry building because his brother had just died of Ebola, and he blamed officials. Obviously, the man was mentally deranged, but he is not alone in his mistrust. Sierra Leone's government is hardly inspiring confidence, said Mariama Kande in the Patriotic Vanguard from Sierra Leone. Authorities claimed they'd closed the roads from Kalahun, the epicenter of this country's outbreak, but locals kept using back roads to conduct their business, and the disease soon spread to other towns. It's not just West Africa that's ill-prepared for a pandemic, said Mike Callaghan in the Toronto Star. Plagues once spread slowly by ship or horseback, but today we carry new pathogens into unsuspecting populations as quickly as we can hop off an airplane. The next Ebola case could show up on another continent, maybe in your city. The world needs coordinated global action on infectious disease, because the problem does not stop at borders, and neither can the solution. Our last Word article takes a closer look at the Gaza tunnels. It's by Jody Rudorin. Gaza, one war, two realities. The terror of Hamas's secret tunnels. The curved concrete top of the tunnel grazes the dark brown buzz cut of Lieutenant Colonel Oshik Azulai, putting the ceiling 5 feet 7 inches above the sand floor. The walls are about 30 inches apart, wide enough for two people to squeeze past each other, unless both are in body armor. It is cool in the tunnel, 46 feet under, and dark, of course. Cell phones do not work. Azulai, deputy commander of the Israeli military's Southern Gaza Division, said this tunnel stretched 4/5 of a mile into Israel, next to a field filled with watermelon, ripe but unpicked because of the war. It ended about 600 yards from Kibbutz Ein Hashlosha, a rural enclave of 325, but was unfinished. Unlike the tunnels used to infiltrate Israel from Gaza in recent days, this one still had electric lines along the wall and carriage tracks used to ferry out dirt. Destroying such tunnels was the stated goal of Israel's ground invasion of Gaza, which began July 17th. But 11 days into the mission, and after Israeli officials say they have found 31 tunnels and destroyed 15, Palestinian militants again penetrated underground into Israel on Monday evening and confronted soldiers in a staging area. Multiple soldiers were killed, a senior military official said, and it was at least one of the men from Gaza. We will not complete the operation without neutralizing the tunnels, the sole purpose of which is the destruction of our civilians and the killing of our children, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel declared in a televised address afterward. It cannot be that the citizens of the state of Israel will live under the deadly threats of missiles and infiltration through tunnels, death from above and death from below. Tunnels have lurked in the dark spaces of Israeli imagination at least since 2006, when Hamas, the militant Islamic movement that dominates Gaza, used one to abduct an Israeli soldier. Far more than the rocket barrages that have sent Israelis scrambling for shelter throughout the bloody weeks-long battle, the tunnel attacks, Monday's was the sixth of the current conflict, have shaken the collective psyche and stiffened resolve to continue or even expand the fight. In cafes and playgrounds, on social media sites, and in the privacy of pillow talk, Israelis exchange nightmare scenarios that are the stuff of action movies. Armed enemies popping up under a daycare center or a dining room, spraying a crowd with machine gun fire or maybe some chemical, exploding a suicide belt or snatching captives and ducking back into the dirt. It takes us a little bit to our childhood fairy tales of demons, said Yuval Brandeis, 50, a political scientist who lives on Kibbutz Sufa, a mile from where 13 militants emerged from a tunnel at dawn on July 17th. It's a very pastoral environment I live in. The quiet, the green grass, the trees. It's not a pleasant thought that you sit one day on the patio drinking coffee with your wife and a bunch of terrorists will rise from the ground. An Israeli military spokesman said that in the tunnels uncovered so far, soldiers have found more than 70 side shafts. Inside the Ein Hashlosha tunnel, they picked up potato chip bags dated as recently as February. Elsewhere, there were dates, water, and crackers, rocket-propelled grenades and automatic rifles, small rooms for sleeping or hiding, a kidnapping kit of tranquilizers and plastic handcuffs, Israeli army uniforms, and a Bosch drill used for digging the tunnels that Azulai describes as a very good one. "It's like a subway under Gaza," he said. Israeli experts said each tunnel would take up to a year and cost up to $2 million to build, involving dozens of diggers working by hand and with small electric tools. The military has known about the tunnel since at least 2003 and had a task force studying them for a year, but was nonetheless stunned at the sophisticated network it found. Intelligence officers tracked the tunnels by watching for piles of dirt and men disappearing into buildings for days, as well as through communications equipment used underground, according to several Army veterans. But radar designed to detect oil or gas far deeper underground, they said, has often failed to find the tunnels, which burrow through mixed soil closer to the surface that technology has not been able to detect. Most of the tools, the physical tools, don't work on this level of the ground. The physics, it's very limited, explained Brigadier General Shimon Daniel, who commanded Israel's Combat Engineering Corps from 2003 to 2007 and has since retired. "This is the paradox. It's not easier, it's more difficult." Israeli political and military leaders mention the tunnel threat nearly every time they speak, and have gained widespread international support for eliminating them. The military in recent days has distributed photographs of tunnels that troops uncovered, and videos of them placing explosives inside and blowing some up. As part of the propaganda push, the military has also invited a few journalists underground for a tour. Azulai, 36, led the way down a huge sand-walled crater that Israel dug to get access to the Ein Heshlasha tunnel and crouched inside. It was perfectly straight. Concrete blocks stood neatly side by side, topped by curved ones. Along one wall ran an iron bar supporting electric cables, including one added by the Israelis. At one point, a few blocks of concrete were missing, rough natural rock in their place. At another, a crushed, dirty water bottle was stuck in the bar. There were a few splashes of green paint. "It's very simple, but very professional," Azulai said of the tunnel, which he said ran 9/10 of a mile into Gaza, ending in Khan Yuni, one of the focal points of the Israeli assault. "We don't have a base of soldiers close to here," he noted. "If they want to attack us soldiers, it's okay for us to be in battle. But they want to use these tunnels to attack women and children." Sderot, the Israeli town of 24,000 near Gaza's northeast corner, has become a symbol worldwide after being battered by rockets from Gaza for 13 years. But it is the kibbutzim scattered along Gaza's eastern edge that are most threatened by the tunnels. "We were feeling pretty safe before," said Mian Barkai, 34, director of Kibbutz Berai, where one tunnel was found over the weekend. "We knew what to do with the missiles. The tunnels? It's game-changing. We can't do anything if the terrorist will come to our kindergarten. The tunnels? It's very surprising. It can hit you don't know where." The rest of the last word section is a second article titled "Shock and Grief After Israeli Airstrikes" by Sudarshan Raghavan. Inside Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, amid the tumultuous rush to save lives, men push a gunnery carrying the lifeless body of a child wrapped in a sheet. A girl in a red dress, her face covered with blood, walked in a daze past the dead and nearly dead. "Oh my God, what has happened to us?" a man screamed, his voice somehow lifting above the din of hundreds of people who clogged the hospital's halls on Monday. They were all perhaps asking the same question. The tragedy began around 4:30 p.m. with an explosion on a narrow tree-lined street in the Beach Camp neighborhood. It was the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Fitr, and children were playing outside, some on swings, some near storefronts and parked cars. Hamas militants blamed an Israeli airstrike. Israel said a Hamas mortar shell went awry. 10 residents were killed, including at least 7 children. At 5 p.m., Ahmed Al-Elu was not thinking of blame, at least not yet. He was at the hospital, crying in front of his father's shattered corpse, a headless tangle of flesh and bone. He didn't notice the dead child in the sheet or the dazed girl in red passing by. A week ago, the family home came under fire in the city's Shijiaya enclave, where Israeli forces and Hamas militants fiercely clashed. Helu's grandmother, his father's mother, was killed in the crossfire, and the family fled to beach camp. The three-week-old war found them there. "My beloved father," Helu's brother cried, standing at his white, blood-drained feet, "you are following your mother." Moments later, the two men helped nurses place their father's corpse in a white bag. A small piece of his body fell to the floor. Ahmed picked it up, unzipped the bag, and carefully tucked it inside. Outside the hospital's morgue, Saleh Ilayan sat on a step, his head buried in his palms. The body of his two sons were inside. The hospital worker came by and asked him to confirm their names, written on a sheet of paper. Afterward, silent and sobbing, Ilayan spotted a boy who resembled his sons and hugged him hard. An ambulance rolled by slowly. Some people peered into the back to see if a relative was inside. A hospital worker pushed an empty gurney, covered with a pool of blood, from the morgue. Inside the morgue, the bodies of 5 children were stacked in a metal freezer, 2 on the top rack, 2 in the middle, and 1 on the bottom. Scores of angry men denounced the killings. "It's the martyrs' Eid," yelled one. "We will not be afraid any more of the Israelis," yelled another. "May Allah take revenge for this," they all chanted a few minutes later. At 6:15 p.m., hundreds of people were gathered in beach camp on the street where the explosions occurred. There was a small crater in the asphalt. Buildings and a white Mitsubishi sedan were pocked with baseball-sized shrapnel holes. 2 torn children's slippers lay in a pool of blood. Yahya al-Derby, 10, remembered how he was playing with his friends on the swing set, a portable contraption set up to entertain children during Eid. He had felt tired and had gone to his house. The other children, residents said, were either on the swings or in the street when the shell or rocket struck. "Most of them are my friends," Yahya said, his hands shaking. As he spoke, a woman approached. She was looking for her sister-in-law's son, Osama. "He had been playing at the swing," she said. When asked her last name, she said it was Al-Helu. She wasn't aware that Osama's grandfather, Ahmed's father, had been killed, and no one had the courage to tell her. At 6:48 p.m., the men of beach camp carried the body of 9-year-old Mansour Hajjaj to the nearby cemetery. It was opposite a house that had been reduced to rubble for 3 days earlier by an Israeli airstrike, residents said. A portion of the cemetery was also destroyed. As per Muslim tradition, Mansour's body was washed and shrouded in white cloth. His uncle, a medic, was used to dealing with corpses. But when he carried his nephew, he was sobbing uncontrollably. The boy's father, Rami, was in worse shape, unable to help bury his son. But as the uncle placed Mansour into his final resting place, his father cried out, "I want to see him." The uncle lifted Mansour and opened the shroud, revealing his black hair. His father bent down and kissed his son's head. "May Allah take revenge for this," the mourners chanted, after Mansour was laid to rest. By 7:10 p.m., they had filtered out of the cemetery. "He wanted to chase happiness on Eid," Rami Hajjaj said, glancing upward as if he were speaking to the heavens. "He was just a kid. This was excerpted from articles that originally appeared, respectively, in the New York Times and the Washington Post on July 29th, reprinted with permission. We'll turn back now to the Health and Science page. Schizophrenia's genetic source. It's been known for decades that schizophrenia has a biological cause, but a new study has linked the mental illness to a complex interplay among 108 genes. The research indicates that variations across many genes, rather than mutations in a small number, increase people's risk for developing the disorder. It's a stunning confirmation that there are many, many genetic factors, Pamela Sklar, psychiatric geneticist at Mount Sinai School of Medicine, tells Nature. About 1% of Americans have schizophrenia, a severe mental disorder that can lead to agitation, hallucinations, and paranoia. Researchers from more than 80 medical institutions across 35 countries compared the genetic makeup of nearly 37,000 people with schizophrenia against those of 110,000 people without it to pinpoint short DNA sequences that were more common in schizophrenics. The findings support an existing theory that problems in the genes that regulate the brain chemical dopamine contribute to the condition. Genes tied to the immune system were also implicated. We now have a massive amount of new biology to investigate, said Dr. Jerome Breen of King's College London, a whole new set of ideas that could provide many potential avenues for treatment. Secrets of sandstone sculptures. How does nature carve those remarkable sandstone arches, like Utah's famed Rainbow Bridge? It's a question that has long puzzled geologists who had thought that the seemingly delicate structures were probably sculpted by wind and rain. But a new study shows that the real artist is gravity. Researchers were inspired by a visit to a Czech Republic quarry where the sandstone, despite being soft and quick to crumble when loose, requires blasting to be broken from solid rock face. Taking samples to the lab, they created sandstone cubes and sandwiched them under weights, then simulated the effects of erosion by rain. As parts of the cubes washed away, the pressure increased on the sand that remained, eventually reaching a point when the grains locked together and became stable. Applying pressure to different areas produced the array of arches, alcoves, pillars, and other shapes that occur in natural formations. It's just the stress that controls the shape, study author Jiří Brutáns from Charles University in Prague tells BBC.com. Add in the effects of wind and rain, and it's a very compelling combination. On the Talking Points page, Paul Ryan, a new anti-poverty plan. Creative ideas are rare in Washington, said the Boston Herald in an editorial. Creative ideas that aren't immediately ridiculed by the political opposition are rarer still. So give credit to Representative Paul Ryan for proposing reforms to government anti-poverty programs that might actually help the poor. The centerpiece of his cost-neutral proposals is to consolidate 11 federal assistance programs, including food stamps, housing aid, and cash welfare, into an opportunity grant that would then be managed by participating states. Recipients would have to meet job requirements and would be assigned a caseworker who would customize their benefits and steer them toward self-sufficiency. The core insight of Ryan's plan is that merely getting checks from the government doesn't make you less poor, said Raihan Salam in Slate.com. Ryan's proposal still needs some refinement, but he is asking the right questions. This plan sounds reasonable until you start thinking about how it will play out, said Paul Waldman in the Washington Post. How are the poor supposed to fulfill work requirements when there are no decent jobs available to them? And combining all benefit programs into a single block grant would make the poor more vulnerable to future cuts and to economic downturns. Right now, for example, the food stamp budget expands with demand. Under Ryan's program, the budget would be fixed, so if too many people qualified, they'd be out of luck. It's also naive to assume that states will act in the best interest of their poorest citizens, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. Nearly every Republican state rejected the federal government's offer to insure the poor through the expansion of Medicaid. Ryan's plan may be his sneaky way of appealing to the GOP base while trying to convince independents he's no longer an Ayn Rand miser. At least Republicans are thinking about new approaches to poverty, said Ross Douthat in NYTimes.com. With Ryan and other Republican reformers jockeying for position in 2016, they are now engaged in serious policy debates. The Democrats, on the other hand, have all but anointed Hillary Clinton to stay on the conventional liberal course, with no real plan for paying the ever-expanding welfare state. Unless Democrats start coming up with their own post-Obama agenda, they're in danger of becoming the party of no hope and no change. Global chaos. Is Obama to blame? There's an earthquake rumbling through the political landscape, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. And it's caused by a collective revulsion against President Obama's dangerously weak and indecisive foreign policy. Americans have concluded that Obama's refusal to take a leadership role abroad, what his aides call leading from behind, has led to the current meltdowns in Ukraine, Gaza, Syria, Libya, and Iraq. To be fair, no one can say for sure what would have happened if the U.S. had not signaled its exhaustion with foreign affairs, said Fred Hyatt in the Washington Post. But Obama's attempts to engineer a cautious, modulated retreat from U.S. leadership have clearly backfired, leaving us with a far more dangerous world. Blaming Obama for what happened abroad is comically stupid, said A.J. Goodman in HuffingtonPost.com. The chaos in the Middle East began with the U.S. invasion of Iraq and the neocons' hubris in thinking we could reshape the globe. While Republican George W. Bush was president, Russia's President Vladimir Putin invaded Georgia and suffered no meaningful retribution from the U.S. In Ukraine, Syria, and Iraq, Obama's options were few and unpromising, said Steve Chapman in ChicagoTribune.com. Do conservatives recommend we send a few hundred thousand troops to each of these messes? Let's not forget that in the golden age of Ronald Reagan, civil wars roiled Central America, Americans were taken hostage in Lebanon, a U.S. military barracks was blown up in Beirut, and the Soviets shot down a South Korean airliner. How come Reagan's tough leadership didn't prevent those disasters? The real problem isn't that Obama's weak and indecisive, says Charles Krauthammer in the Washington Post. I strongly suspect that his passivity stems from an idea that Obama articulated in 2009. The arc of the moral universe is long, he said, but it bends toward justice. Obama seems to sincerely believe that history will see to the defeat of tyrants and terrorists. Therefore, it's a mistake to try to stop Syria's Bashar al-Assad from slaughtering more than 100,000 civilians, Islamic terrorists from seizing a third of Iraq, and Putin from invading Ukraine. But while waiting for justice to arrive, how many innocents will suffer and die? The job of a true leader is to shorten the long arc of history. Otherwise, why do we need a president? And a few short notes as we wind down the hour. Because of the Great Recession, the net worth of the typical American actually dropped 36% from 2003 to 2013, from $87,992 to $56,335, according to a study by the Russell Sage Foundation. Meanwhile, the average net worth of the U.S. household in the 95th percentile grew 14% to $1,364,834. While the world's attention has been focused on Gaza, nearby Syria last week endured one of the bloodiest weeks in the three-year-long civil war. At least 1,700 people were reported to have been killed in fighting among the Syrian regime, ISIS, and other rebel groups. Americans are shelling out more on medical care for our pets than ever before, more than $15 billion this year alone. A recent poll found that nearly two-thirds of pet owners would pay up to $1,000 for life-saving treatment, while 25% say they'd be willing to fork over $3,000 or more. On the poll watch, 25% of Americans think that Israel has gone too far in its military response to its conflict with Hamas in Gaza. 35% say Israel's response is about right, and 15% say it hasn't gone far enough. 40% say Hamas is the most responsible for the violence, while 19% say that Israel is. And we'll wind up with two different quotes. The first one comes from Will Rogers. He says, "Everyone is ignorant, only on different subjects." And we'll finish with one from Groucho Marx, quoted in the Jewish Chronicle. He says, "I intend to live forever or die trying." Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.